people telling me that America is the greatest country because we can whip your ass?
I hate some of these people, but I'd never kill them.
How do you deal with this? You're never going to be able to unsee what you saw.
Try to impeach him. Just try it. You will have a spasm of violence in this country like you've never seen.
Governor Snyder, I got some Flint water for you.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, and you've got to make it stop.
If nobody's going to do it, then I got to do it.
And I don't give a who you are. I'll fight you in the damn street right now.
Okay.
How the did this happen?
The American dream is dead. Stop resisting.
The president's powers here are beyond question.
Ladies and gentlemen, the last president of the United States.
Coming to an American city near you.
The trailer to Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 11/9. It opens today in 1,800 theaters across the country. Well, earlier this week, Michael joined us in our studio. I began by asking him about the making of the film and if it's a sequel to his 2004 blockbuster, Fahrenheit 9/11, about George W. Bush.
It's not a sequel. The title just sort of came to us because Trump was declared president by the Associated Press at 2:29 in the morning on 11/9/16. But it is a cousin to that film in the sense that when Bush was installed in the White House and had us in a couple of wars fairly quickly, we were in pretty bad shape. And so Fahrenheit 9/11 grew out of a desire to try and halt his efforts, especially the war effort. We're in a different kind of war now. We're in a war with not just an individual who's taken over the White House because, again, he wasn't elected, but he was appointed by the Electoral College. But Trump is the result of decades of us allowing this country to go down a road that had very little to do with democracy and equal rights and what was fair, and very much toward letting the rich, letting corporate America, Wall Street, run the show and call the shots. So when I say that, for instance, that Donald Trump doesn't care much about democracy and is trying to whittle away whatever he can of what we call our democracy, that's really, to be fair to him, not really unusual. He's a CEO. He's a billionaire. Generally, CEOs don't run their businesses like democracies. They don't like democracy. That's not how they live. It's not how they run their business. And as billionaires, they want to grab as much of the pie for themselves as possible. So they're not into everybody having a slice of the pie or a fair slice of the pie or a seat at the table. So he's really just acting like most people of his class. I got to believe if you're a billionaire, you've got to really hate a system that says it's one person, one vote. Because if we really are one person, one vote, that means there's 325 million of us and probably less than 1,000 of them. Imagine if you were on the other side, if you were one of them, that doesn't look very good because it means that 325 million can just suddenly pass laws and tell you what to do. So the basic concept of our democracy is that. But they know that they've been able to run that show because they've bought it. They buy the politicians, they buy the elections, and they have most working people in such a box that they know that if they were to protest, if they were to speak out, if they were to whistleblow, that would be the end of their income. And starting with Bill Clinton, we began eliminating the safety net when you don't have an income. And so we're now at the point where they've got those 325 million right where they want them, scared that they aren't going to be able to pay next month's bills. That statistic I saw recently, maybe you saw it, the majority of Americans, almost 67%, do not have enough money in the bank or in their pocket to if a loved one passed away tonight and they lived here in New York and the loved one was in California, they don't have the money for the plane ticket to go to California. In other words, they don't have $400 to $500 available in any form to them at any moment. That's the America we live in. And boy, does the billionaire class love that, because that's when you've got them. You don't ever think about when you're in that situation of complaining about what's going on, starting a union, or taking the day off to go to the funeral of a loved one.
So you go, Michael Moore, way back with Donald Trump. And in the film, you show
this. You mean
this.
I personally go way back?
Yeah. Let's go back to 1998, when you appear on Roseanne Barr's talk show along with Donald Trump.
My next guest is kind of the polar, philosophical polar opposite of Donald Trump, I think, but maybe not. We'll find out. His first film was the classic documentary Roger and Me, which was so great. Please welcome my blue collar panelist, Michael Moore.
He's terrific, I tell you. I loved what he did. Oh. If I was Roger, I wouldn't have liked it, but I enjoyed it. I hope he never does one on me, though.
His nightmare begins September 21st when your film is out, Fahrenheit 11-9. So talk about that moment at Tavern on the Green in 1998.
Roseanne's sitcom was over, and, you know, it was one of the most popular shows ever. She had a very working class, very good. Her whole thing back then was really solid, good politically, everything. But the show was over, and ABC decided to give her an afternoon show. And so she called up and said, come on the show. They did it in L.A., but they were going to do a week in New York at Tavern on the Green in Central Park. And I said, sure. And I get there, and I didn't realize Trump was going to be the other guest, which I was very happy about. So he wasn't. He didn't know I was going to be on the show. 2 years earlier, we were both booked to be on the old Politically Incorrect. I think back then it was on Comedy Central, before it was on ABC.
Bill Maher's show.
Yes, his first show. And when I got there on Politically Incorrect, and he saw that I was there, he split. They were like, all of a sudden, without a guest, a fourth guest on the show. He would not appear anywhere with me, and he did not know I was going to be on Roseanne, and now he's really upset.
And you've done Roger and Me already.
Yes, this is 10 years after Roger and Me, almost 10 years. Yes, and I've done TV Nation at that time, and I was in the process of starting The Awful Truth, which was the TV Nation when we moved it to another network. So he decides to leave again, and they ask him to please wait. They come to me and they say, oh, my God, he's going to leave because of you. We don't want you to leave. Can you just talk to him? Can you just calm him down or whatever? And I said, sure, sure. So I went over to him. And this part isn't in the movie, but I go over to him. I shake his hand. It's all clammy. And I don't know why he's all nervous about me. And they said, you're thinking of leaving. Well, I don't want to, like, go up there on the show. I don't want to go out and mix it up. And, you know, I said, this is an afternoon talk show. It's Roseanne. It's comedy. Just relax. Don't leave. And essentially, I kind of promise him not to go after his, by that point, his various real estate dealings, how he's treating the workers, the Central Park Five, discriminating against, I think, out of the thousands of apartments they had out in their so-called middle-class housing in the boroughs, 7 were rented to black families. And to get him not to leave, I sort of promise him, he does the show, and you'll see when you see the movie, I'm joke around, but I don't go after him.
So you're the reason he's president today?
Well, I'm just saying, I didn't realize till later, especially until when he was running and I was watching his performance art, I thought, wow, this guy is good. When he talks about the art of the deal, he was playing me. He was negotiating the moment so he would be left alone by this documentary filmmaker who goes after corporate CEOs. And I thought, man, so this is how he's gotten this far. If he was no good at this, if he was just a charlatan, he wouldn't have lasted this long in New York City. He really knew how to play it and to play people. And so when I look at that now, I just think, you know, even though I'm 20 years younger there, and I know you want to say I couldn't tell, but I'm like, all these years later, I'm thinking, wow, you never back down, Mike, I'm saying to myself. And you back down mainly because I felt bad for Roseanne so that her show wouldn't be ruined that day. Now, here we are in 2018. I don't feel bad about Roseanne at all. She's totally gone off the cliff. You know, when I see the two of them together on the show, you know, they're the enemy at that point. Now in what do you call the opposite of hindsight? Present sight, future sight, wherever we're at now, we know what the score is.
Your film, you start with that remarkable day, but you actually start before. And you were talking about this way before. You wrote in July 2016, again, before Trump was elected,
right,
five reasons why Trump will win. In it, you wrote, quote, Donald J. Trump is going to win in November. This wretched, ignorant, dangerous, part-time clown and full-time sociopath is going to be our next president, President Trump. Go ahead, say the words, because you'll be saying them for the next 4 years, President Trump. You went on to list the five reasons you believe Trump would be president. Trump's focus on the Midwest, the last stand of the angry white man, the Hillary problem, the depressed Sanders vote, and what you call the Jesse Ventura effect, people voting for Trump simply to disrupt the system. You were predicting this well in advance. And you show anyone who says something otherwise in the corporate media, this moment of George Stephanopoulos and Keith Ellison is priceless.
Yes. First of all, I take no pleasure in being right. I never wanted to be more wrong when I wrote that. But I had just come back from the UK, where my last film, Where to Invade Next, had just opened. And so I went and did press throughout the UK, in London, in Sheffield, ending up in Belfast. And a lot of crowds and theater screenings with the working class of the United Kingdom. This was the week before Brexit. And I saw what I see and hear a lot in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio and elsewhere, where people didn't necessarily like or like were in love with the idea of Brexit, but they loved being able to have the chance to go into the voting booth and throw a Molotov cocktail into the middle of a system that had left them broke and in despair. And when we left the UK there just before the vote, you know, we were all saying, that my crew and friends, wow, this just sounds like many parts of the United States. It looks like Brexit's going to pass, even though all the polls said that it wasn't going to. We came back here, and of course, all the polls, you know, Brexit did pass, and all the polls here were saying that Hillary had it in the bag.
The day that Brexit passed, Donald Trump flew into Scotland to push the sale of his golf course.
Yes.
And a young comedian stood up right before he spoke on this windswept precipice and said something like, Donald Trump's balls are available in the golf shop.
Yes.
And he's showing these red golf balls
with
swastikas on them.
There were people who were trying to warn everybody else to not treat this as a joke, to take Trump seriously. And so I immediately started, I wrote that piece that you just referred to, and I went on Bill Maher, and I told the audience there that Trump was going to win, and he was going to win by winning Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, the three states, electoral states that he won by. And I got booed. I got booed on Bill Maher. People did not want to hear it. And I said, look, I'm not saying it because I want that to happen. I'm saying it that we better realize they're having the Democratic convention this week, and they're popping the champagne corks as if it's a done deal. Because everybody's mindset then throughout August and September and October was that, how could she lose to this guy? And in fact, she won. She won by 3 million votes. So that part people had right. But I just kept telling people, look, you're not looking at the right picture here. You're all liberal arts majors. You suck at math and geography. This is going to come down to the Electoral College. Are you counting this? Yes, in those popular vote polls, she was ahead. But that's unfortunately not the way the president gets picked. And because the Democratic Party and others have led no fight to get rid of the Electoral College since President Gore won in 2000, you'd think after that people go, you know, this Electoral College, I think it's time for it to go. No. Now, there have been good people who've got the national popular vote thing going, and they've got it passed in a lot of states. If you haven't heard of this, go on nationalpopularvote.com. We have to get enough states to pass this law. The law says your state's electors will go to whoever wins the popular vote. We've had got enough states now that have passed this where we're up to 172 electoral votes. So we just need enough states that have 98 electoral votes left, and then that's that. And now the winner, who actually wins the popular vote, will be the president of the United States. So there's a possibility of fixing this without having to go through the machinations of changing the Constitution. So to get back to what happened in the summer of 16, I couldn't get anywhere, and I couldn't convince Democratic Party leadership types. I couldn't get people who vote Democratic to listen to me. I started to feel I must have communication skill issues because somehow I'm not getting this through to people. You're not taking Trump seriously.
And you're talking about the blue states that Obama had won that you thought Trump was going to win.
Yes.
Ohio and your home state.
And Pennsylvania.
And Michigan.
Right. And I just couldn't get anybody to listen. Nobody thought it could happen because, are you kidding? He's such an idiot. He's crazy. I said, that's why he's going to win. You know, you don't understand. He's an incredible performance artist. People love The Apprentice. I mean, people between the Hudson River and Interstate 5 love The Apprentice. They loved him on it because here's what he did every week. Whoever the biggest jerk was on the show that week got to hear, you're fired. And everybody works with that jerk. Wherever you work, there's that one jerk. And the cathartic feeling you got watching The Apprentice of hearing somebody fire that jerk. People loved that show. And they loved Trump. And they loved hearing him say, you're fired. But I couldn't get anybody to listen to this because on the coasts, within the bubble of the Democratic Party infrastructure, they don't watch The Apprentice. They also don't watch The Bachelorette either, by the way, which is a great show. I'm just saying that I pay attention to what my fellow Americans are watching and listening to.
So where does Gwen Stefani fit into this picture?
Well, this is what I have known from the beginning of this, is that Trump found out. He was in negotiations for re-upping The Apprentice with NBC. And he found out that Gwen Stefani, who's one of the stars of The Voice, another show you're not watching.
You can't say that about me, but you're looking at the audience right now when you say that.
I'm actually looking at the entire audience. The people watching right now who know that they don't watch The Voice or The Apprentice. We can't watch anymore. That one's off the air. Anyways, he found out that somebody else is getting paid more than him on NBC. And not just somebody else. Can I say it? A woman. A woman was being paid more than Donald J. Trump. And that, you know, makes him go like this. So he decides that he's going to show NBC. He contacts another network to put them in competition for each other for The Apprentice. And then he comes up with this idea of holding an announcement, not for real, just it's going to be a pretend thing. He's going to hold an announcement announcing he's running for president, and he's going to have a couple rallies, and he's going to show these networks just how much the American people love him out there in that vast, wide swath of land. So that's the big plan. But then so he comes down the escalator, makes the announcement, and goes off the rails and starts calling Mexicans rapists and criminals and murderers and whatever else. And a few days later.
And people cheering.
Well, the people are cheering. If you've seen that escalator, I think by now most people have seen the escalator coming down with Melania. The people cheering down there are extras. And he's paid extras $50 a piece to be there in Trump T-shirts and holding signs and, you know, all of that. It's all fake. It's as fake as the gold-plated escalator he's coming down. It's gold-plated, folks. It's not real gold. He comes down. He says this about Mexicans. And within days, NBC fires him. It goes completely against what he thinks is going to happen. And now they don't want him at all. And now he's lost his job because of his racism. He's already booked and paid for these two events. I believe one was in Phoenix and one was in Mobile, Alabama. And, you know, they're paid for. They've rented the arenas or the auditoriums or whatever. Now, this is the part that I'm not privy to his conversations with Don Jr. and Eric, although I usually am. But not this one.
I'm going to ask you about your relationship with Jared, but that's coming.
Okay, I'm ready for it. I'm here. This is full transparency. But they decide, we've already paid for it. Let's go and do the rallies. So they go and do the rallies. And we show in the film the look on Trump's face. There's 40,000 people in that stadium in Mobile, Alabama. And he cannot believe it. I mean, he's never been in front of 40,000 people. He's never had that experience like you and I have. So I show the look in his face in my movie. You see the epiphany taking place in his head. It's like, well, maybe running for president isn't such a bad idea. To hell with NBC and The Apprentice. And he decides to actually go ahead with it. Remember early on where pundits and people were saying, there's no campaign apparatus. There's nobody in charge. There's no place. How do you donate to the campaign? Right? It was all that. He's not really running. He's not really wanting to do the job. This is just some kind of stunt. I mean, it was kind of obvious to everybody. But I actually show how the stunt got launched. Mm-hmm. And then we end up being the losers for it in the long run because he decides he likes it. He loves these crowds, and they just keep getting bigger. And the rest is history.
And you have people like Les Moonves, now disgraced, who is saying things like, you know, it's great for us. It just may not be great for America.
Les Moonves, who was the head of CBS, and Jeff Zucker, who is the head of CNN, both kind of copped to the fact that they were putting him on the air a lot for free. He didn't have to pay for any of this. It's why Hillary, if you look at what she spent, he spent about $300 million. She spent almost $1 billion. On her campaign, he'd have to spend $1 billion because he got all this free airtime from the mainstream networks. And in the film, I show Moonves and Zucker yucking it up over how great it is that Donald Trump is running, because it was very good for business and they sold a lot more ads.
So you have the red carpet treatment from the networks, you know, wall-to-wall coverage of his speeches. Often, I mean, the other candidates, like, for example, Bernie Sanders, got nothing like this,
right,
even though he had some of the largest crowds of any of the candidates, right, Republican and Democrat. I want to go back to that moment of George Stephanopoulos and Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minneapolis.
Yeah, so Keith Ellison is on the Sunday morning show that George has on ABC. And Keith says, very seriously, you know, you should take Trump seriously. He could end up leading the Republican Party ticket. And George Stephanopoulos just starts laughing hysterically. And our good friend Katrina over at The Nation, she's there on the panel. She's laughing. I mean, everybody was laughing. People watching the show were probably laughing. I mean, nobody really took it seriously, because it just, a lot of bad things can happen in this country. That is not going to happen.
This man has got some momentum, and we better be ready for the fact that he might be leading the Republican ticket.
Next. I know you don't believe that, but I want to go on.
Sorry to laugh.
But a few people, like Keith Ellison, were trying to warn people, you've got to take anybody seriously when they say something like this. And I think now, after all this time, we realize that Donald Trump is always lying and he's always telling the truth. And you have to be able to operate on both levels with him.
Explain.
Well, when he says, I could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and get away with it, you know that he's not going to shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, I hope. But you know he could get away with it. I mean, both are true. And it's always that way with him. So I pay close attention to him when he says things that sound crazy and you think he's just being crazy. I always go, well, you know, he may mean that. I mean, even in the film, when he says that about, we're not going to arm teachers, after Parkland, Florida, we're not going to arm teachers. And then within 2 seconds, he goes, well, maybe 20% of them. And then 2 seconds later, it could be 40%. It's like he says one thing that could be the truth, but he switches it up within seconds. This happens all the time. He'll switch something up the same day or within a day or two. Part of that process, and this is the evil genius of Trump, is that he knows how to keep, especially liberals, all scatterbrained and not knowing what's going on. Wait a minute, he said that. No, he said that. No, he said that. When people say something, we take it literally. He knows he can just say stuff, get everybody discombobulated, and he becomes the master distractor. He knows how to get people off the topic and onto something else so that we won't really be paying attention to what he's really up to.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Last week, ICE agents fanned out in raids like this one in every state,
ripping children away from their families under this new policy.
Yeah, that's almost there.
Who made it better?
Who?
Guatemala.
No llores. Vas a llegar con... Mira, ella te va a explicar y te va a ayudar.
Papá, papá.
Taking babies away from their mother and locking up one or the other and separating them because they did no harm to anybody. They just didn't comply with the stupid regulations. That's a crime against humanity, in my judgment.
Ben Ferenz, the last Nuremberg prosecutor. Explain, Michael Moore.
Well, I wanted to go speak to him. I didn't realize there was only one surviving Nuremberg prosecutor. He lives just outside the city here, and he is a witness from the past, a witness to what happens when you allow fascism to become the way of life and the law of the land. He's very powerful, the things he says in the film. At one point, he says that Donald Trump, in doing some of these things that he's done, is committing crimes against humanity. And he says, you know, I can't deal with this because I'm thinking we hung people for doing some of these things, for behaving like this. One of the inspirations to make this film was a book I'd read back in the 1980s by Bertram Gross called Friendly Fascism. In the book, Gross says that the fascism of the 21st century will not come with concentration camps and swastikas. It will come with a smiley face and a TV show. That the fascism that will take hold in the 21st century, there won't be a lot of guns fired because the population will be brainwashed enough. First, they'll be dumbed down, you know, ruin their schools, reduce their press, put whistleblowers in jail, and then brand things, the smiley face. Don't use swastikas. Just make it happy. You're going to be happier if you go my way, the Trump way. And this is what I find most frightening when I think about and what I hope this film does in terms of ripping the mask off what's really going on here. We are on a precipice. We are on that edge. Democracy has no self-correcting mechanism. It's a piece of paper, the Constitution. I know we like to get all teary-eyed and all goo-goo about, you know, our wonderful Constitution. It's a piece of paper. And it's the human beings in each era that decide exactly what's going to go on, which part we're going to listen to and which part we're not of this Constitution. And if we get too close to the edge, where we've given up too many of our rights, where we've allowed the democracy to be whittled down, where we've made voting a most difficult thing to do for people who have the right to vote and should be voting. If we do all of that, it could easily fall off that cliff. Before you know it, it could be gone. And you have to operate with that. You'll hear from people on other networks or other shows I'll be on, well, Mike, why are you making the comparisons between Hitler and Trump? And I always say to them, well, that's really not the movie. The movie is more comparing us to the Germans, the good Germans, one of the most civilized, cultured, educated, liberal democracies on the planet Earth. And they went along. There was a national emergency. The Reichstag burned down their parliament. And Hitler said, the communists did it. We got to get rid of these communists. And sure enough, you know, Hitler's party got 32% of the parliament in 1932, 32%, which was the most. 19% went to the communists. And then the others were mostly liberal left parties, social democrats, etc. By Hitler getting rid of those 19 communist seats or the 19% of the seats of, you know, all of a sudden he had a chance to take those. 19 and 32 is 51. Now you're the majority. But he was worried. Hitler was worried that, this is a little, I'm pushing this a little here. The people, we're a democracy. They're not going to like this. So he holds a plebiscite a number of months later, holds a plebiscite and asks the people, yes or no, are you okay with us, the Nazis, taking over here, and I'm going to be both president and chancellor. Hindenburg had one of those jobs. He was an old man, and then he died. He just died. He was old. He was died. Not trying to pin that on Hitler, okay? But he died, and Hitler said, I should have his job. I should be president and chancellor. Can I? And they went and had an election, and the majority of Germans voted yes. And I show that, the ballot, in the movie. They voted yes for this. And the front page editorial in the Jewish Weekly of Frankfurt, Germany, said, okay, everybody, fellow Jews, calm down. It's okay. Yes, he's crazy. Yes, his people are thugs. But, you know, it's not going to be as bad as a lot of you are thinking. Come on, we're Germans. This is a democracy. You know, we are not going to be rounded up and put into ghettos because we have a constitution. This is the editorial in the Jewish Weekly.
You held this up during your Broadway play.
Yes, right. And it's in the movie because I want people, anybody who is still thinking, Mike, calm down, Mike. I mean, Trump. I mean, yes, he's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, but come on. You know, don't be scaring the people like this. I'm not scaring anybody. If you are not already terrified by what he is doing, by what he is up to, I'm serious. And everybody else needs to get serious, too. I took this man seriously from the beginning, and I'm here, and I'm telling you now that he has his plans for the way he'd like things to be. He has no intention of leaving the White House. He knows he cannot be indicted. He knows the Constitution won't allow Mueller to indict him. He can be an unindicted, not co-conspirator, but he'll be an unindicted criminal. But he doesn't think he's going to be impeached. He's going to call it all rigged. Even if he loses the 2020 election, he'll say it's rigged. He has plans for calling off the election. Republicans last year were asked if he wanted to postpone the election. because of all these illegals that are voting. You know, if Hillary got those 3 million illegal votes, would you support him postponing the election? 52% of Republicans said that they would support Trump postponing the 2020 election. We have to get serious about this, and we have to be real. And if I could just say one last story. I tried to convince Steve Bannon to sit down in front of my camera so I could ask him some questions. He said, well, I'll need to talk to you first. Let me come by and we'll see. And he came over to my production office. And I sat there with him for 2 hours talking to him. And I said, just tell us, really, how'd you pull this off? How did you and Trump outsmart maybe the smartest candidate ever to run for office, just on pure IQ alone, perhaps one of the smartest? And he said, well, I have a very easy answer for you. Our side, we go for the head wound. Your side, you like to have pillow fights. And that's why we'll win, even though I agree with you, as he says to me, and as I show in the film, there's more of us than there are of them. He's not afraid of that because they're fighters, and they will stand up and they will fight for the things they believe in. And they know we will back down and we will compromise and we will say, OK, Obamacare is OK, even though it's not really universal health care. We'll go along with that. You know, we're just happy that our kids could be covered until they're 26, you know, and we just rationalize all this stuff. And they know that about us, and they know how to defeat us with that. They have no intention of going away. And this is the angry white man party. And they know their days are numbered because this nation right now is almost 70% either female, people of color, or young adults between the ages of 18 and 35, or a combination of those three things. That's America. They know it. They know their days are numbered, and they're going to try to grab whatever they can and suppress the vote and gerrymander it and do whatever they can, pack the Supreme Court, whatever it is, they're going to try and do it because they know we will not put our bodies on the line to stop.